It's a university of Waterloo and it's somehow also a perimeter institute. What's his title? What you can read. The title is Separations of Probabilistic Theories via their Information Processing Capabilities.
Okay, thanks, John. Okay, first of all, I'd like to thank Paul and Lucy for giving me the opportunity to speak here. What I want to talk about today is really, it's a follow-on from John's talk. We're going to talk about a few things within the same framework. In particular, I want to talk about three ideas, well, which have come from quantum information theory. And that's to do with the no planning and no broadcasting theorems, the generalization of the phonetic theorem, and the possibility of teleportation. I'll talk about a little bit at the end. So I'm going to give a little bit of motivation, which maybe expand upon some of the things that John said earlier. I'm going to go over the framework again very rapidly, hopefully. But some of my notation differs a bit from John's, so should be trivial. There's a few remarks I need to make in order to understand the rest of the talk. Okay, so let me start off with a motivation and a question that I think a lot of people will ask about this sort of work. You know, why should we study these information processing tasks and these generalized theories? Obviously, the world is quantum mechanical, or effectively classical, at certain levels. Those theories describe the things we can actually do. But there are, I think there are four main questions which we can try to address with these kinds of frameworks. I guess one of the original motivations for people in quantum information to start looking at these things was the idea that we could come up with novel axiomatics for quantum theory based on information processing. So several people, including Gilles Brossard, Chris Fuchs, Clifton Booth, and Halvorsen, have tried to look for axioms which are explicitly in terms of quite high-level information processing tasks. There are a few other questions which come up. So one question which gets asked by people in quantum information who are of a little bit of a philosophical bent is what features of quantum mechanics can we pin the blame on, essentially? So which features are, you know, uniquely responsible for these enhanced information processing powers, and how can we exploit them? There's another motivation which John touched on as well, which are generally called security paranoia. If you talk to, if you look at work in the field of cryptography, and in quantum cryptography in particular, you're usually interested in improving the security of a protocol under the most general set of assumptions that you can possibly think of. So if you even look at quantum key distribution, the standard proof of quantum key distribution, and look at the kinds of things that it's assumed that an eavesdropper can do, well, it's anything allowed by the laws of physics. Okay, so it's it's things that are way more powerful than people can actually implement in practice at the moment. But what you're interested in here is to find essentially a weakest set of possible assumptions, such that you're looking for a kind of a minimal set of things. So a lot of things could possibly go wrong with our current understanding of cryptography protocols, and yet things still be secure. So people in cryptography are interested in that sort of thing. These, I guess, they're all subsumed pretty much under, you know, what is my main motivation, which is just to understand the logical structure of these information processing tasks, which things imply which other things. Is there a fundamental set of primitive ideas about quantum theory that we could use and derive all of cryptography from, for instance? When you start looking into these questions, it's quite clear that they're all related. They're all essentially in some way the same question. And it's quite easy to forget when you start looking into this stuff which of these questions you're originally trying to answer. because essentially they're all asking the same question, which I think is subsumed by this last question, understand sort of the logical relations between the various information processing tasks. Let me give you some examples of some things which could be sort of quite confusing in our current understanding of things. So John talked a bit about quantum key distribution, and he talked about the idea that you could think of measurement disturbance as being behind the power of quantum key distribution. Now that's true to a certain extent, but if you start looking into the formal proofs of security of quantum key distributions under a very, very general set of assumptions, then you'll find a variety of different proofs in the literature which start from different assumptions about quantum mechanics. So probably the most famous proof by Shor and Preskill was based on the idea of monogamy of quantum correlations. So if Alice and Bob are in some pure entangled state, then neither of them can be entangled with any eavesdropper. There are proofs which are based on the uncertainty principle, which I have in quote marks there, because really all we mean here is the idea that there are non-commuting observables. There's a sort of new class of proofs in the last few years which try to prove the security based mainly on the idea of violation of null inequalities and the non-signaling principle. So if you ask yourself the question, well, which of these features is really responsible for the security of quantum key distribution, then there's really no answer to this question. It's any one of these things can be taken as your starting point. And the reason is that these things aren't unrelated to one another, right? If you have some framework for a physical theory and you have maybe one of these things, then you're going to have some of the other issues as well. Now, there are also a few informal arguments in the quantum information literature, at least the first one of these I want to talk about a bit in this talk, which people use to sort of do heuristic reasoning about how things should be related. So in particular, there's the idea that the ability to clone some set of states, so to make a copy of a set of states, is in some sense equivalent to the distinguishability of those states. Now that's something that's true in the framework that I'm going to talk about today. You could conceive of, it's possible to conceive of physical theories where this isn't true. It's true in Hilbert-based quantum mechanics, it's true in the framework. So I think it's sort of interesting to try and set out a minimal set of assumptions in which this kind of connection holds. I also had an argument in a recent paper that monogamy of entanglement was roughly the same thing as no broadcasting, and no broadcasting is something I'm going to talk about today. Now, really, I mean, all of these ideas are a bit, it's not quite as straightforward as I made it look, because it's really not these equivalences that hold, but this plus some other assumptions about the physical theory, some other assumptions that come from Hilbert space. So people in these papers may be making use of many things which are true in Hilbert space in addition to these things, such as, you know, maybe the spectral theorem or whatever. But one thing that's common to these kinds of arguments is that they don't seem to require the full machinery of Hilbert space quantum mechanics. We can get away with something less and still have the same ideas go through. So the framework that we're talking about, that we're working in, is one of a general class of frameworks, I would say, which you can call a generalized probabilistic framework. And a generalized probabilistic framework is something which roughly looks like this. We have our canonical examples of theories, which are classical probability theory and quantum theory. And it's well known that they can be fit in within a framework for physical theories, which is a generalization of classical probability theory, and that's the C-star algebraic framework. So in the finite dimensional case, we're just talking about quantum theory, classical theory, and quantum theory with superselection rules, but this can all be made rigorous in infinite dimensional spaces as well. But there's also the idea that, well, maybe the C-star algebraic framework itself is hard to motivate from purely operational principles. It's hard to, you know, sort of go from thinking that I'm talking about a generalization of probability theory to writing down that framework exactly. So in these frameworks, you have some more generic theorists. You have a larger space of theorists. And it's supposed that you know, the assumptions that lie behind these generic theories can be directly motivated by operational considerations, as John explained in the last talk. Now, it's not true that you have to use... this picture doesn't apply only to the framework that I'm talking about today, but, you know, pretty much many of the things that have been discussed over the years in, for instance, the quantum logic literature could be thought of as falling into this kind of framework as well. There's also another competing idea out there, which I just want to mention, because it's related to something I'm going to say later. And that's the idea that what we're talking about is not a generalized probabilistic theory, but a specialized probabilistic theory. So you have classical probability, the space of classical probability distributions over, say, three outcomes in this case. And then quantum theory itself could be regarded as a specialization of that. Okay, so you don't get the full set of probability distributions. And roughly speaking, one of the ideas behind this is, well, one way of thinking about this is it's a bit like the uncertainty principle, right? In classical theory, you can have a full set of possible distributions over position and momentum, but the uncertainty principle is telling you that quantum theory lies within that. Now, you can make this idea more precise using the idea of informationally complete measurements. Okay, if you have informationally complete measements, then there's some inherent fuzziness to quantum theory, whereas classical probability theory has these dispersion-free states. Now, I don't think that these two different approaches to thinking about the problem are entirely distinct. And in particular, we'll see that the framework that we have of this type gives rise to a framework of this type as well. But I think it's worth thinking about the connections between those two a bit more than has been done today. So I want to talk about three theorems in this framework. And they're associated to different types of separation of the theories that you can get in this framework. So as John was saying in his talk, it's really rather easy to find things which uniquely pick out the classical theories as the only ones having some special property. Okay. So many of the things we think of as uniquely quantum are actually more generically non-classical. And the one example I'm going to talk about today of that is cloning and broadcasting. So in one sense, that's bad news. It's bad news maybe for the axiomatic program, if you're hoping to find natural things which will get you to quantum theory. But on the other hand, it's good news if you like to generalize the theory of information processing, because what it tells you is that maybe a lot of quantum information theory can be generalized fairly easily to the whole generic framework. There are also... theorems and ideas and protocols which are going to work generically in the entire framework, including quantum classical and Emory theory. And this is going to be expected too, right? Because what we're dealing with here is a generalization of classical probability theory. And if it's really a well-motivated generalization, then you're going to expect that some theorems from classical probability theory, like a lot of theorems from classical probability theory, should have generalizations. And we're going to talk about one such thing, which is the Dicconetti theorem. And then perhaps the most interesting type of separation, which we don't have many examples of yet, are sort of the non-trivial separations, which do something more interesting. You might be interested in, for example, ideas which are going to separate the classical and the quantum, for instance. But the one we have an example of here is the idea of teleportation, whether you can do teleportation in a theory. And this is, we don't know exactly where this boundary lies yet, but it's going to look something like this. So in all C-star algebraic theories, there's no teleportation, but there are definitely some theories out here which are ruled out by the requirement that you have teleportation. Okay, so now I want to briefly review the convex set framework that John talked about. So just a reminder, this is to be thought of as an operational framework in the sort of traditional sense. And the idea is we're thinking about sort of laboratory experiments where you have things like preparation devices, transformation devices, and measurement devices, each of which has some knob setting. You can choose to do various different preparations, transformations, and measurements. This measurement device, in addition, has a number of, let's say, flashing lights, which can come on. And the preparation device has something like a go button, so that you know when you're doing an experiment and when you're not doing an experiment. The goal of such a theory is going to be to predict the probabilities of outcomes given some choice of preparation, transformation, and measurement. And so to develop a mathematical framework, we need to just say how each of these things is going to be represented in the theory. So the set of states are the things that represent the preparations. And I'm going to start by just positing the set of unnormalized states. So in John's talk, he started with the set of normalized states. You can do it either way around. So this is just some set V, which is a compact closed convex cone. Now, convexity in this sense means that it should be closed under arbitrary positive linear combinations with positive scalars. In finite dimensions, and I'm going to make a spanning assumption of finite dimensions unless otherwise specified, although many things I'm going to say could be formulated more generally. You can think of these cones as being embedded in Rn, right? So some vector space of dimension, a real vector space of dimension n. You can always do that. But I sort of prefer to speak about the abstract structure of the cone as opposed to some particular embedding, just because there are various embeddings in Rn which are all equivalent. Okay, so if I make any invertible linear transformation of some cone in Rn, it gives me the same theory. So I prefer to work with a more abstract definition where I just have the cone. There's also a privileged section of the cone, which should be a closed convex set, which is the intersection of a hyperplane with the cone when you're thinking about it in Rn. And that's the set of normalized states. And when you have that, you can write every unnormalized state as some positive coefficient times one of the normalized states. And this is just the normal of the state itself. So the extreme points of this convex set of normalized states, or the extremal rays of the cone, are going to be what we call the pure states of the theory. Okay, so here are the standard examples. Classically, you have the probability simplex. You have convex combinations of the probability simplex and the zero vector as a kind of unnormalized states. Quantum, you have the cone as the semi-positive matrices, the normalized states the density matrices. And another natural class of things to think about is when the set of normalized states is some polyhedron. One of the simplest examples, this is just the square cone embedded in Rn. So John already introduced this idea of the dual cone, which is a set of positive affine functionals on the cone. So this is a set of functions that take an element of the cone to the real numbers, and they're positive on all states in the cone, and they preserve convex combinations. So this actually induces the cone induces a partial order on the set on the dual cone, which is defined in this way. So if the value of a function is smaller than the value of some other function on all states in the cone, then we'll say that f is less than or equal to g. There is two privileged functions. So John already introduced the idea of the unit function. essentially the unit function just returns the normal state. So normal, it can be defined by saying on normalized states it gives you 1. The zero function maps everything to 0. And then we can define the set of normalized effects, or just the set of effects, to be all of those functionals that lie within the unit interval with respect to this partial order. So this just means they're things that acting on any normalized state give you a number between 0 and 1, which can be interpreted as probability. And so these are the things that are going to represent the measurement outcomes of the theory. So here are examples of those unit intervals. In classical theories, you just have the what I call fuzzy indicator functions. This just means indicator functions and convex combinations of such sort of indicator functions. Quantum theory, you have the PAVM elements via the canonical mapping between a linear functional and the trace of some positive operator to an density operator. For the simple example of a polyhedral cone, I've drawn some of these things. Maybe this gives you some better geometric intuition about what these things look like. So the dual cone is essentially just, in this case, just a rotated and squashed version of the original cone. And this condition that you must have probabilities gives you this octahedral cone. Okay. So for present purposes, we can collect together effects into an observable, finite collection of effects. And that will be called an observable if it sums to the unit. Okay, so it will give you a probability distribution. This is analogous to the idea of a PAVM in quantum theory, as opposed to a spectral observable. You can give a more sort of sophisticated measure theoretic definition if you want to deal with infinite collections, but I won't bother doing that here, simplistic. Now, I want to talk again about informationally complete observables, which John mentioned. An observable induces an affine map. You can think of it as an affine map from the normalized state to the probability simplex of dimension n. Okay, so this is just the n-dimensional probability distributions. And this map is defined by just saying it maps omega to the probability vector, where each component is the probability associated to the corresponding effect. It's just sometimes convenient to talk about this mapping as opposed to just the probabilities themselves. And an observable is called informationally complete whenever you have two distinct states. I should say that omega is not equal to mu here, then these two probability distributions are distinct. You can prove, and John sort of roughly mentioned what the proof was in the last talk, so I won't go into it, but every state space has an information complete observable. I think that's true in general as well, but here we're only going to need it for finite dimensions. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through tensor products. John talked about them. We have the idea of the separable tensor product, which is the convex hull of the separable states. And we have the maximal tensor product, and a nice way of thinking about that is that you take the separable tensor product of the dual cones, and then you re-dualize again. Okay, this is essentially a very sort of compact way of saying what John said on that slide about the maximal tensor product. And for our purposes, a tensor product is going to be a convex cone that satisfies these inclusion relations. So I need to talk about dynamics a bit more. So again, the dynamical maps of a theory are a convex subset of the affine maps. Okay, and I'm generally allowing dynamics from one state space to another, which might be distinct at state space. So they have to respect mixtures. A few useful concepts. Whenever you have an affine map, you can define a dual map, which acts on the dual space instead of the state space. This is like the difference between the Schrodinger and Heisenberg pictures in quantum theory. this map is uniquely defined by this equation. And I'll say a map is normalization preserving if it preserves the units. So the unit of VB, or the unit of VB star gets mapped to the unit of VA star. And this just means that the normable states will be preserved. And these are the things that are going to represent things that you can do in the theory without having to do any selection. Okay, so the same maps that you can implement deterministically in the theory. I need a technical requirement as well for some of the theorems I want to show, which is that the dynamical maps, remember they're a convex subset of the affine maps, and I want to require that all maps of this form are in the set. And what this means physically is I'm just saying that I can always, if I have a state, I can always do some measurement of it, get some outcome with some probability, then completely throw away the system and prepare the system in a new fixed state. That's what this map says you can do. And I'm just assuming that those are in there. Right, okay. So now I can begin to talk about cloning and distinguishability and the connection between cloning and distinguishability in these things. So now suppose I have a finite set of states, normalized states. I'm going to say they're jointly distinguishable if there exists an observable, well, that distinguishes them. Okay, so for each of the omegas in the set, there's some outcome of the observable which it gets probability 1, or the other outcomes it gets probability 0. And a simple fact to prove, and I think John might have mentioned it as well, at least in finite dimensions, if the set of pure states is jointly distinguishable in a theory, and if and only if the set of normalized states is a simplex. Well, I think that's fairly intuitive. I won't say how you prove that. Okay, so now the connection to cloning. So if you remember from the quantum cloning theorem, the idea of a cloning map is whether you can copy a state. Okay, it's a question of whether you can copy states in a theory. So a cloning map in general is going to be something that takes you from one copy of your code to two copies, where this can be any tensor product. And we'll say that it claims some state if it just gives you two uncorrelated copies of the state. Okay, so it's fairly easy to see that every state has a cloning map because I assume that you could, you know, prepare arbitrary states. Basically, I could just throw away the system and prepare an arbitrary state. So if I'm just interested in cloning in a map that claims a fixed state, then I can, if I want to a map that claims omega, then this map will do it. And that's in the set by the assumption we made. So the interesting question is when a set of states is what we call co-clonable, or jointly clonable, which means there must be a fixed normalization-preserving affine map that clones all of them at the same time. Okay. So in quantum theory, the no-cloning theorem says that there's no cloning map for any pair of non-orthogonal quantum states. But we can generalize that, and the theorem says that a set of states is co-clonable if and only if they are jointly distinguishable. Okay, so let me just roughly tell you what the proof of that is. It's essentially just formalized folklore that you see all over the place in quantum information literature. But the first point is that if you have joint distinguishability, then I can do the observable that distinguishes the states and then just prepare two copies of the state. That direction is simple. If you have co-clonability, then essentially what you can do is you can iterate the cloning map as many times as you like. You can make as many copies of the state as you like. And then we have these informationally complete observables. So they can be used to distinguish the states, and then you need a law of large numbers argument to say that everything converges in the right way in the limit. That's the only technical part. But essentially, the intuition is fairly simple. So what this says is going back to this picture, well, the universal planing of pure states in particular is only going to be possible in classical theories, because any non-classical theory has some states that are not jointly distinct. Okay, but in quantum information, there's also been a generalization of the idea of cloning, which is more appropriate when you're talking about mixed states. And this is the idea of broadcasting. So to describe what this is, I need to tell you a bit about marginal states and marginal maps. So if I have a state in the tensor product, any one of these tensor products of the two codes, then I can define marginal states, for example, on VA, by just essentially saying that the action of any effect on this marginal state is given by just plugging in the unit functional to the other system. So this is the analog of the partial trace in quantum theory, or just marginalization in classical probability theory. Those are special cases. I can also do a similar thing if I have a map which takes me from a single state space to the tensor product to other state spaces, and I can define reduced maps which just map this state space to one of the two components. And that's defined in the obvious way. You just apply the map and then apply this marginalization operation. Okay, so this map defines two reduced maps. Okay, so now the idea of broadcasting is pretty simple. I'll say that a state is broadcast by a map if both of the reduced maps leave the state fixed. Now here I'm using primes and double primes to indicate as subsystem labels. These cones are supposed to be isomorphic to one another, so the primes and double primes are just used to indicate the distinctness of the subsystems. Now, what happens is that cloning is a special case of this, where we additionally require that the outputs have to be uncorrelated. In broadcasting, you can, for example, produce an entangled state, and that's perfectly fine. For instance, if you would, in quantum theory, if you'd like to broadcast the maximally mixed state, then you could just produce the maximally mixed state of the two subsystems. That would be a cloning map. But you could also produce a maximally entangled state, because the marginals are both maximally mixed. And that would be an example of broadcasting, which isn't cloning. Okay, so for mixed states, the two notions are distinct, whereas actually, for pure states, it turns out that broadcasting and cloning are the same thing. Okay, so now I should mention that in quantum theory, the no broadcasting theorem says that a set of states, I should make this definition first, of course. As before, I'll define a set of states to be co-broadcastable if there exists a single map that broadcasts all of them. Now, in quantum theory, a set of states is co-broadcastable if and only if they commute. Okay, so they're all diagonal on the same basis. And I should also say that in classical theory, all states are broadcastable.
That means simply they are orthogonal.
No.
The states commute, means that in an open space, models are orthogonal.
They're diagonal on the same basis. So they can be, there's a set of orthogonal states, and each of the states is a convex combination of those states, but they need not be orthogonal. In classical theory, you can broadcast everything. So if you think about the example of a single bit, if you have a single classical bit, it can be in the state 0 or 1, and it's in an arbitrary probability distribution. Well, if you just simply copy that bit, so you either have two copies of 0 or two copies of 1, then the marginal states are the same as the original probability distribution. So I just have two correlated copies of the same random variable. And you can always do that classically. In general, you can prove an analog of the quantum theorem, which says that a set of states is co-broadcastable if and only if it's contained in a simplex that has jointly distinguishable vertices. Now, actually, I just want to go on to the next slide, which illustrates that a bit better, maybe. So this generalizes the quantum result. So here we have our full set of a normalized state, some convex set. Inside that, we have a simplex, the extreme points of which can be distinguished. Okay, any set of states that's co-broadcastable lies within something like this. Now, the idea of being in a convex combination of a state being a convex combination of distinguishable states is a generalization of the idea that states commute. So, the idea that they're diagonal on a common basis. Okay, because if states are diagonal on a common basis, then with respect to those, then those basis vectors are distinguishable, and with respect to that, all of the states that are broadcast are convex combinations of those states. So it's a natural generalization of that idea. So again, this implies that universal broadcasting all states, is only possible in the classical theory. We also have a sort of slight converse, which is a bit of a funny theorem. If you take any affine map, you can think of the set of states that's broadcast by that. So for most maps, that set will be nothing. Most maps don't broadcast anything. But if a map broadcasts any states, then the set of states that it broadcasts is precisely a set of that form. So that was the example of something where you get a separation between classical and non-classical theories. Next, I want to talk about a result which holds for all theories, which is the Definetti theorem. So we have Definetti theorems that are well known in classical probability and in quantum theory. So for those of you who aren't familiar with this kind of stuff, roughly speaking, what it is just a structure theorem for a certain class of symmetric classical probability distributions in the classical case, or symmetric quantum states in the quantum case. The reasons people are interested in it are, there's a couple of different reasons. One has to do with the Bayesian or subjective interpretation of classical probability theory. So this is the idea that probability distributions represent some agent's information or belief or knowledge about the system, and they don't represent objective properties of that system. If you adopt that approach, and I'm not necessarily saying that you should, at least not today, if you adopt that interpretation, then you have a problem with the idea of an unknown probability distribution. So remember, one of the tasks in statistics is you have some random variables which are coming to you in an unknown probability distribution, and you want to figure out what that is. That doesn't make much sense in this kind of interpretation of probability, because of course an unknown probability is a bit of an oxymoron. The probability is already always known by the person whose degree of belief it represents. So we need an argument to justify the fact that you can determine, that you can devise standard statistical techniques to determine an unknown probability distribution. And we also need an argument which justifies the use of relative frequencies in updating the probability assignments as is done standardly. That's one motivation. It has other applications too, for example, in cryptography. Particularly the finite versions of the theorem, or the quantum theorem, are used in proofs of security of quantum cryptography. And so there are other reasons for wanting to study this theorem. It's a nice structured theorem in any case. So I don't think studying this rests on whether you are interested in this stuff. So here I'm going to try to define things without too many equations, because it gets pretty complicated. But here's what the theorem is about. We have k copies of the same state space. Okay, so here the numbers are just labeling different copies. And we have some state that I'm going to call omega k on these k copies. Now, this state is supposed to have the property that it's invariant under permutations. So I can do an arbitrary permutation to these systems here, and I'll end up with the same state. But there's a further requirement, which is that the state should be extendable to a symmetric state on a larger system. So if there should be a state on, for example, k plus 1 systems, such that it's also invariant under permutations, but omega k is the marginal state when I marginalize it with subsystem. And the concept of exchangeability says that this should be true for any arbitrary positive integer. Roughly speaking, the intuition behind this is you're imagining a situation where somebody is giving you a bunch of systems, you're doing a measurement on each one of them individually, and the judgment of exchangeability is the idea that you don't care what order you get the results in. Okay, your judgments would be the same if you did the experiments in a different order. It's roughly the assumption that you can do repeatable experiments. And this assumption that you can create an exchangeable family essentially means that you could imagine that the experiment you've done could be embedded in an arbitrary long sequence, right? Which you also assume normally in science that you could have done the experiment many, many more times if you'd have wanted, and the result wouldn't. So there's the assumptions. And here's the theorem. So this is our generalization of the classical Definetti theorem. Any exchangeable state can be written in this form. Okay. So what you have is there's some probability measure over the set of normalized states, and weighted with that probability, you have a tensor product of all copies of the same state. Okay. I should explain a few things here. First of all, this is a standard probability density. We're in finite dimensions. The measure, the sort of measure on the state space, is a slightly non-trivial thing. But you can induce a measure on the state space by looking at an embedding in Rn. Remember, all these finite dimensional cones can be embedded in Rn. And then there's the standard measure on Rn, and then you can lift that up to a measure on the state space itself in a standard way. And any such embedding, any invertible embedding in Rn, the measure you get will do the job. You can always write it up. This is for finite dimensions. If you wanted to do an infinite dimensional version of this theorem, you have to be a bit more careful. So this is, let me just explain a little more. This is what replaces the assumption of independence within the Bayesian approach, right? Because here you can imagine that what this is saying is you might as well think that the system is in one of these states, many, many copies of the same state, and what you're trying to find out is this probability distribution, so the unnamed probability distribution of the states. And if you apply Bayesian updating to this thing, or apply Bayes' rule to this whole thing, then essentially what you end up doing is a Bayesian update of just this probability distribution. So I won't go over those kind of details. I just want to roughly outline the proof. It's just a straightforward generalization of the proof that Caves, Fuchs, and Schack gave for the quantum theorem. So what you do is use the idea of an information-complete observable for the system. And then you have to notice that if I take tensor products of these effects on an arbitrary number of systems, then that becomes informationally complete for the larger system. So this is something. In order to get this, this maybe answers Lucien's earlier question. This crucially depends on the idea that you have this local tomography condition. Now, this thing generates a probability distribution when I make the measurement on an exchangeable state, and it will be exchangeable. It will inherit the property of exchangeability from the state in the arbitrary theory. So we can use the classical Definetti theorem on that. And you know, here I'm viewing this as finite dimensional probability simplex. This is the J1 component of the probability vector here. So this is what it says for the classical case. Then there's a final step, which is that we have to verify, in order to get back to the general theorem, we have to verify that all these probability vectors that appear here are of the form of something that we would have got by applying measurement, by applying the information in complete measurement to some state in the theory. So, I don't want to go all the way back, but if you remember the diagram I drew at the beginning where you have probability simplex and then the set of states that you get lies a convex set that lies within that. Okay, you have to check that these probability vectors lie within that convex set that you get from the information complete measurement. And if you do that, then you can invert this and go back to the form that I had on the previous slide. This is the technical part, which I might go through. So, interesting thing about this, I guess, is that the assumptions for the Definetti theorem are rather weak, and you have to go all the way outside our framework in order to break it. One place where it breaks down, I've discussed before, is the real Hilbert space quantum mechanics, because it doesn't, well, in the context of this proof, it doesn't satisfy this property here. So, the last, yes, sorry.
Do you know a breakdown, or are you put in more?
Do you know what the status of that counterexample is at the moment?
Sorry, which counterexample?
The counterexample to the Definetti theorem for real Hilbert spaces. Okay, so the original counterexample that was presented was not correct. But we know for sure that it breaks down. Anyway, this is something this is something we should discuss at a later date, because it has a bit of a convoluted history, this this
counterexample.
I'm pretty sure it breaks down, yeah. Okay, so finally, in the last few minutes, I want to talk about teleportation. Teleportation, imposing that a teleportation protocol exists may seem like a rather bizarre thing to do to a theory. But it turns out to be related to a lot of other interesting things to do with the tensor product. And I think that there are other motivations which would get you to the same point. When we started out with the idea of teleportation, this is something that you can do in classical and quantum theories. Let me just briefly remind you of the quantum teleportation protocol in pictures. The task is that Alice has some quantum state, some unknown quantum state, and she'd like to transfer it over to Bob. But they don't have any quantum channels to use, so there's no way of sending a qubit from Alice to Bob. What they do have is a classical channel, so they can talk to each other over the phone, and they share some entanglement. They share a Bell state entanglement. So this can be used to transfer the state. What happens is that Alice takes the unknown state and her half of the Bell state, the measurements in the Bell basis, four outcome measurements, communicates the result to Bob. And it turns out, very simply, if you go through the math, that if depending on the result of this measurement, if Bob does one of the identity or one of the three Pauli operations, he recovers the state. So that's the standard teleportation protocol in quantum mechanics. What I actually want to talk about is the idea of a conclusive teleportation, so this is a bit of a weaker notion. So here, it's the same kind of thing, except for two caveats. The first thing is, we're only going to allow Alice to do a two-outcome measurement here. But we're all going to allow the protocol to fail sometimes. So the idea is there's a two-outcome measurement here. One of them is the yes measurement, the other one is the no measurement. If Alice gets the yes outcome, Bob should recover the original state. If she gets the no outcome, then we don't care what happens, we say the protocol failed. Now in quantum theory, you can do this by just doing a measurement which asks, are these two systems in this state or not? Okay, if that succeeds, then the output state is is the original input state. Okay. So this all generalizes very easily now. What we now have is three state spaces, all the same, but with different subsystem labels. We have some unknown states here that we would like to transfer from Alice to Bob. We have some fixed bipartite states. This is basically the same state for all possible inputs. And we have some fixed two-outcome measurement. So we just have to specify a single effect here. Okay, and we'll have this and the unit versus this, and we'll have two outcomes. So you do this measurement on the two subsystems, you ask, did I get this outcome? If you got this outcome, then you want Bob's state, Alice's state, to be recovered here. If you don't get that outcome, then you want, then you don't care what happens. So we know quite a few things about this now. It's actually still a work in progress to fully classify this. But I just wanted to mention one interesting theorem, which was proved by Howard Bonnet, essentially. If this generalized conclusive teleportation is possible, then the state cone has to be affinely isomorphic to its dual. Okay. A few comments about that. First of all, we don't know that this is sufficient, and it seems very unlikely that it is, because there are some examples of theorists we don't think you can do teleportation. It's a weaker notion than what's perhaps the more mathematically natural notion, which is that of a self-dual cone. So a cone is self-dual if it has an embedding in Rn such that the dual cone is equal to the original cone.
Right?
Yeah.
Now that's not known to be sufficient. And so obviously whether you can do teleportation depends on your tensor product.
Sure. So when I say not known to be sufficient,
if you choose the minimal tensor product, and you get shot, you can't do.
So what I mean is, given a code that's isomorphic to its dual, does there exist a tensor product for that space such that you can do teleportation? That's what I would mean by sufficiency. Now, one thing that I think is really interesting about this is that it implies that tensor products and dynamics are the same thing in such theories. So I'm not going to explain how that works exactly, but given a tensor product of two spaces, I can that turns out to be isomorphic to a set of dynamics and vice versa. For those of you in quantum information, this should remind you of the Yabokovsky isomorphism. I have to say it's not quite the same thing. It's actually something that's strictly weaker than that. But it's a similar kind of idea. Let me just give you an example. So here, going back to those examples, this square cone here is an example of something that is affinely isomorphic to its dual, but not equal to its dual. Okay. So if I make any linear transformation of this cone, then I always end up with a cone which is, although isomorphic, they're related by invertible linear transformation. I always end up with something that's a slightly rotated version of the code. Okay, so that's in particular example.
Can that be viewed at least in some somewhat fuzzy way? Assuming that what comes out the other end when you teleport is actually kind of an element of the dual space as opposed to the original?
That's more or less exactly how it works, yeah. I mean, so you can view a state as a mapping between a state space and the dual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if you have, this is one direction of the proof, says that you have to have, there has to be some isomorphism between mappings on the state space. Well, at least for the identity map. It's roughly how it works. You have the right intuition there.
So if you do that, if you were to try to do teleportation in a theory that was not isomorphic to its dual,
it would have to fail for some states.
So you get a sort of a garbled, partial, non-faithful thing out the other end because you'd be squashing onto a different cone.
Well, you get a state out. You always get a state out of the other end.
Right.
I mean, I can explain how proof works to you later. It's probably not a good idea to go through all the details. Okay. So this is kind of an interesting separation. You know that it lies somewhere here. So we know that you can do teleportation in all C-star algebraic theories by construction, or this thing that I was calling generalization of teleportation. There are theories like that one with the square cone, which are which have cones isomorphic to their dual that are definitely non C-star algebraic. But then there are also theories which are just not isomorphic, where the cones are not isomorphic to their duals. So the interesting project right now is to work out exactly where this separation like lies. Yeah.
If you ask for complete teleportation or no post selection, it's not clear to me whether it would be weaker or stronger or just different.
I think it's stronger, yeah. Because, we have looked into that a bit. There are a few preliminary results on that because essentially you need some constraints on the group of automorphisms in the because you have to have these recovery operations.
So you can't imagine in theory where it's not possible to do it with post-selection, but that the point is that even singling out one element is one thing, but in your theory, there's also no readjustment that you need to do.
Right. So yeah, I think that's right.
That's what I'm saying.
Or
are you defining everything up to an isomorphism so that doesn't
work? Well, actually, the proof of that would go, doesn't. Essentially, we are defining things up to an isomorphism in this.
I can say a little bit. So yeah, essentially up to an isomorphism, so we're not worrying too much about the correction of the other end. Still, there's another sense in which our usual notion of deterministic teleportation is not stronger or weaker than this inclusive thing. Because here we only have one measurement outcome, which we demand to work on all states, and has a finite probability of actually happening on all states. Whereas in a deterministic one, you can imagine several different outcomes. Which work on all states, so each of them individually might not have one zero probability of the states to be seen. I mean, so it's not clear that like deterministic teleportation applies this notion or the other way.
That would be for infinite energy.
Anyway, I mean, so we still have to work out the full details of deterministic teleportation and how these things are all arranged in this thing. I just wanted to show you that, you know, at least we have, you know, one concrete example where we know that the dividing line is a bit non-trivial. So just to finish up, to summarize, well, I presented really three different things. So one of the messages of both this work and John's earlier talk is that many features of quantum information, which are usually thought of as genuinely quantum mechanical, should instead be thought of as generically non-classical. They hold in all non-classical theories in the framework. Good news is that we can generalize much of quantum information and quantum probability beyond the usual C-star algebraic framework. And these things to do with cryptography, it seems very straightforward to do that. There are some more non-trivial separations which are going to come out in this, hopefully. But one in particular is one to do with teleportation. There's also John's conjecture to do with computation, which will give you more non-trivial kind of separations. These are harder and have yet to be fully characterized. So here are just a few open questions. One thing that would be very interesting would be to do a full version of the finite definitive theorem for these theories, because this is useful in the proofs of security of quantum cryptography. So finite definitive theorem assumes that you don't have this infinite exchangeability, but only up to some finite number. And the question is, how close do you get to one of those states of definitive form? Some metric. I know that there is a finite definitive theorem. The question here is just about how good the scaling is, whether the scaling of that is good enough to do the kinds of reductions in quantum cryptography. So that part of it is non-trivial. We need to look more closely at necessary and sufficient conditions to tell the patient. There are some other protocols. John mentioned a security distribution. I think it would be interesting to do a full security proof that whether the standard techniques work. This is, should be related. Oh, there are also proposals for sort of entanglement-based quantum key distribution, and I think it will be not too hard to get a full security proof to work out for that. There's the question of bit commitment. Can you do bit commitment? So there's a famous theorem that says you can't do bit commitment in quantum theory. You can't do it classically. We think there are some theories in the framework in which you can do it, and others in which you can't. And this is going to be related to constraints. As teleportation, this is again going to be related to constraints on the tensor products and the dynamics. And those are the interesting things to look at. Sort of vague question is to ask, you know, which primitive things about quantum theory, vague question I started with, which primitive things can you think of in quantum theory that together are sufficient to uniquely quantize, characterize quantum information? That's a bit of a vague question, but here you might be looking for something. What I'm looking for here is something weaker than the excitation program, right? So I don't necessarily care whether I can, to answer this question, whether I can fully derive quantum mechanics. But there's a certain set of phenomena, at least you can write down the set of phenomena that we have in quantum cryptography that we care about, that we're able to prove the security of. And we can ask, what's the minimal set of things that theory has to satisfy in order for that those things to be true? And we can ask this kind of question for all sorts of quantum information protocols, and this, I think, gives us a better understanding of the logical connections between these things. Okay, so just finish with some references. The stuff on claiming and broadcasting is available on the archive. Apparently, there will be a paper on the Definetti theorem very soon once it's written up. So thanks for your attention.
Questions? Can you give a simple example of a cone that's not isomorphic to its dual cone?
It's hard, not one that can easily be drawn, because it's true that, well, actually, it's true that all polygon cones generated by polygons are isomorphic to dual cones. Is that right? No, we just have to choose a non-regular polygon, something like that. Yeah. So you have to go beyond the triangle, you have to go to at least 4 points. You know, if you choose some kind of, you know, quadrilateral as your generating set, it's not a square. The thing is that what will happen then is that the dual cone will be generated by something which roughly goes to the center of these things. But then, so it will look something like this. that can work as an example.
The
generic case is for it to not be isomorphic to its dual. It's just the easiest examples are higher dimensional and hard to draw. But
and let's see, your theorem was necessary and sufficient.
It's a necessary condition for teleportation, and probably not sufficient, right? So the question is, given any theory in which the cone is isomorphic to its dual, can you construct a tensor product such that teleportation is possible? There's definitely going to be some tensor products for which it's not possible. We know examples of that. The question is whether you can construct this in general. And I think there are some theories which is not going to be possible for. So in fact, that square cone theory might actually be ruled out by this. But we haven't
It would help if we knew if given a co-isomorphic to a dual and another one, is there always a tensor product which is itself co-isomorphic to its dual?
Right, right.
If anyone knows that, could be grateful for the
answer. Yeah, okay. I mean, that's a natural condition as well, independently of this particular proof. I mean, something that I didn't mention is that you want these kind of properties to be robust under combining subsystems anyway, right? So really, you don't just want cones that are isomorphic to its duals, but cones which can be combined in some way such that the combination is also isomorphic to its dual, because you would want to be able to do teleportation for arbitrary subsystems as you can in quantum and classical things.
So you tossed off several references to infinite dimensions, mostly saying you weren't going to talk about them.
Yeah, some things have been proved in infinite dimensions, although right. not recently.
So if you go to an algebraer or an algebra operator theorist, then of course they'll say pish-posh and say that all the interesting stuff is infinite dimensions and the finite dimensions are incredibly boring. So let me go the other direction and make a provocative question here. Is there anything about infinite dimensions that is interesting and relevant to quantum information and quantum gravitation?
I don't know. I mean, I think infinite dimensions, or at least continuous systems, pose a challenge in the sense that the idealized things that you assume you can do in finite dimensions, you can't necessarily do with continuous variables. So you're always dealing in continuous variables with an approximation to the ideal protocol rather than the actual protocol itself. But this is at least a practical consideration that you have to take into account in the implementations of these things.
But
conceptually, I don't know whether there's anything that's really, really amazingly different.
Yeah. So you briefly mentioned the question of whether kinetic theorem tells for real open spaces.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, do we know if this status is turning on open spaces?
My understanding is that there's problems with talking about combining subsystems at all in that, and that's a prerequisite for even stating what the theorem is. So I wouldn't even know how to formulate it, turning on the systems.
I mean, it seems it's difficult to talk about infinitely covariant systems. I mean, if you have if the number of measurements you have to make for the composite system is less than the product, then it seems it's difficult to talk about unit pair independently.
So you drew the Venn diagram where there's C star algebraic theories and then more general ones.
Yeah.
All of the more general ones that I can think of, and just off the top of my head, seem to be things you can embed in a C star algebra.
Think about the theory which has PR boxes, for instance. So stronger than quantum correlations. All C-star algebraic theories will obey the Cyrilson bound, but the dominant quantities, for instance. So you can easily put things in this framework which violate that.
Is that true for even stable sub-negative
I think that's true, yeah, that was proved in the... I still have made Cyrilson. That's in a paper by Howard Barnum and a bunch of this paper on had to do with tensor products and these kinds of theories, but when that result's proved. In some sense, that's the motivating example. I think, you know, when we started thinking about these kinds of things, the question was, people have been doing lots of work on these PR boxes in quantum information theory, investigating the information processing tasks. So could we come up with some actual full description of physical theory, including dynamics, which had these as an example, and you know, also contained classical and quantum as examples. So I guess thinking about PR boxes is one of the things that led to thinking about this framework at all.
Okay, well, there's no more questions. Thank you.